There is a large picture window in Aspen Lodge that looks out over a small green clearing and beyond that the tall trees of Maryland's Catoctin Mountain Range. It is a placid, peaceful scene, visible tonight to four men in the lodge talking of world peace.
The news department of the National Broadcasting Company presents Khrushchev in America, report number 11. Another in a series of special broadcasts dealing with the visit of Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev to the United States. Your narrator is Herb Kaplow.
An olive-drab Marine helicopter lifted itself off the green lawn of the White House at 5:18 this afternoon, bore off toward the Washington Monument nearby, then turned northwestward toward Maryland's Catoctin Mountains. It was a perfect autumn day, cool and sunny, and there was a gentle breeze. Probably very few of the people in the thousands of cars crowding the Washington streets realized that in that helicopter above them rode two men whose decisions this weekend may influence the future of peace or war. They flew together, Nikita Khrushchev, chairman of the Council of Ministers of the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, Dwight Eisenhower, president of the United States of America. 36 minutes later, they arrived at Camp David, the actions there over this weekend being watched by hundreds of news people stationed at Gettysburg about 15 miles away.
This is Martin Agronsky, NBC News, reporting from Gettysburg. Mr. Nikita Khrushchev is where he has always wanted to be, at the summit. It is a purely American summit, a picturesque one, 1,822 feet up, on the crest of the Catoctin Mountains, a spur of the Blue Ridge that begins at the Potomac River and runs through Pennsylvania and Maryland. The President and the Soviet Premier, Russia's Foreign Minister Gromyko, our Secretary of State, Mr. Herter, our UN Ambassador, Mr. Lodge, advisors in the Russian and American delegation are all at dinner now in the Aspen Lodge, the picturesque wooden rambling cottage where the four men, the President, Mr. Khrushchev, Mr. Gromyko, and Mr. Herter will spend the next 3 days talking about the prospects for peace and presumably settling some of the problems which can lead to world peace. The setting could not be more pastoral, could not be more pleasant. And certainly Mr. Khrushchev will have his opportunity here to be in seclusion with the President of the United States, away from the crowds, an opportunity to think, an opportunity to talk, an opportunity, it's hoped, to decide.
Earlier this afternoon, Mr. Khrushchev attended a luncheon with Secretary Herter. Remarks were exchanged in the form of toasts. The Soviet leader, in speaking of the Camp David rendezvous, said, "We will do all we can in our talks with the President to the advantage of both sides, and on our return we will strive to improve relations. We know," said Mr. Khrushchev, "our people will approve our work here. They greatly desire improvement of relations." After the luncheon, which had been closed to the press, Secretary Herter came outside and read reporters his toast.
"Mr. Chairman, Soviet guests, you have now been in our country over a week. You've had a crowded schedule, and I can assure you we admire your stamina. In this short period, you have visited some of our major cities and met a number of local government officials and private citizens. You've experienced differing situations, just as persons in political life in this country meet them daily throughout this country. We want you to see us as we are. The airing of differences in our free society is normal and actually promotes better understanding. Beginning this evening, you will have opportunities for quiet discussion with President Eisenhower at Camp David. We hope those discussions will create greater understanding between our countries and thereby serve the larger cause of world peace. We also hope you will take back with you a good impression of the United States, its people, and way of life."
Mr. Secretary, as the eve of the Camp David talks, do you have any impressions as to this man's reaction, how he's going into them, what sort of frame of mind as a result of talking to him at lunch?
Well, no. I think when I was asked to come out and read this particular toast, I was not going to be subjected to questioning on the overall visit. I'll say this, that the chairman was in a very good frame of mind, seemed genuinely pleased with his visit to date, and himself expressed the hope that the talks that he will have shortly with the president will be fruitful in better understanding.
Tonight, Nikita Khrushchev, Dwight Eisenhower, Christian Herter, and Andrei Gromyko are housed in the luxurious Aspen Lodge, a rustic cabin set in the quiet solitude of a Maryland mountain range. There will be aides and interpreters in much of the time, but the attention, of course, is on the diplomatic quartet, which it is hoped finds amongst this peace and isolation a range of truer harmony.
This is Bob Abernathy. Nikita Sergeyevich Khrushchev is proud, dedicated, and tough. Every American who has visited Khrushchev recently, Adlai Stevenson, Averell Harriman, Vice President Nixon, and the rest, each says that in private conversation, Khrushchev is a blunt, shrewd antagonist who tends to filibuster and reveals under the earthy peasant charm a will of steel. His moods alternate in private in much the same dramatic way as they do in public. Khrushchev is tough, too, in his view of the world. His outlook might be called power realistic. It means that he sees East-West relations in terms of naked force and what force can achieve. For at least a year, Khrushchev's reading of the East-West power balance has been that the East was at least as strong as the West. Therefore, the East could probe and try to tidy up what Khrushchev sees as unrealistic situations, a free West Berlin, for instance. Khrushchev's power realism makes it unlikely that he will be giving anything away at Camp David. And Khrushchev is dedicated. Dedicated to international communism as the wave of the future. Khrushchev is willing, even eager, in a hurry, to help bring about this change he believes inevitable. Finally, Khrushchev is proud, perhaps not so much of himself as of all his country has achieved in 40 years. Khrushchev wants trade and disarmament, but only once during his talks with U.S. leaders so far has there been a hint that he was willing to concede anything to achieve what he wants. That hint came from Adlai Stevenson Wednesday, who thought Khrushchev might be willing to accept disarmament inspections stage by stage. Otherwise, those who have talked to Khrushchev agreed with the businessmen with whom he dined last night. The Russian leader wants what he wants, only on his own terms. Although he is generally well informed, Khrushchev still tends to see this country through a cloud of 19th century Marxist dogma. But he does have great respect for President Eisenhower. Perhaps that respect will help balance the Khrushchev who seems so intractable.
This is Peter Hackis, NBC News, Washington. The world's best-known bridge player would probably like nothing better than to begin his private weekend with a relaxed, friendly game of cards. But bilingual relaxation, by the time each bid and move in the game is translated into both languages, may be almost as difficult as bilingual international negotiation. The same might be true of bilingual fishing or even of a putting contest on the president's green next to the Camp David Lodge. These are the things which most relax the president. But his relaxation tonight and tomorrow with Premier Khrushchev may be limited to that peaceful, close-to-earth kind of natural relaxation which comes to people in such a setting. Mr. Eisenhower is known to like the lack of crowds, the quiet, the opportunity to reflect upon the problems at hand. There is the hope, no doubt, in his mind that Mr. K., fond as he is of his own dacha in the woods outside of Moscow, will react similarly. Both men have met before, they've dined together, they've negotiated, they've argued before. They're known to be completely dedicated to their respective causes, but both say they're hopeful of compromise at this meeting. Chances are that before Sunday there may be an occasional raised voice and a table pounding from both men. Mr. Eisenhower enters the talks about as confident of himself as he has been in years. He has just come through a bloody but generally successful battle with Congress, which showed his political capabilities. He's buoyed by the mail he's received backing his stand on Berlin, disarmament, and the like, genuine expressions from the people. He's also seen their expressions to Khrushchev of their solidarity behind the president and his foreign policy. Mr. Eisenhower himself has warned the nation not to expect miracles from Camp David. Perhaps, however, the favorite spot of Mr. Eisenhower for relaxing can produce the beginnings of an atmosphere favorable to reaching understanding. If so, the talks the two will hold together in Moscow later this fall could conceivably mark the beginning of the end of the Cold War.
This is Leif Eade. This afternoon, on the south lawn of the White House, a very tall man on crutches bowed slightly and waved the door Soviet Foreign Minister Andrei Gromyko into a waiting helicopter. Then he handed his crutches to the army sergeant serving as steward and himself climbed in. Christian Archibald Herter was on his way to his first real opportunity to prove himself as Secretary of State, to gain the esteem of his boss, the President, and the respect of his adversaries. Because before this, Herter hasn't had that opportunity. Almost immediately after he was appointed secretary last April to succeed the late John Foster Dulles, he was off to Geneva for the abortive Foreign Ministers' Conference. For 10 weeks, that meeting never got to the stage of negotiations. The order from Moscow was "Niet." Khrushchev wanted to talk business with President Eisenhower, and he got his way. For the 2 years that Herter was undersecretary, he was the number two man in a one-man show. The State Department and U.S. foreign policy were John Foster Dulles. As a matter of fact, Dulles dominated all Western policy by sheer power. What's Herter like? Well, he's very tall, 6'5", and generally walks with crutches because of a painful arthritic condition. He has a fine, intelligent head. He is intelligent, well-read in the affairs of the world. He has a courtliness of manner and a softness of speech that makes him seem shy. Actually, he is not. He has an easy laugh and radiates warmth of personality. All these have made some question whether Secretary Herter is also tough. Tough enough to deal with the Russians. Dominant enough to make policy out of the many conflicting opinions within the State Department. Some of those who work closely with him say that Herter has now taken hold, that from now on we're going to see a real Secretary of State. Not another Dulles. With President Eisenhower, no one can ever replace John Foster Dulles. But a secretary who needs no crutches to stand on his diplomatic legs.
This is Robert McCormick, NBC News in Washington. Soviet Foreign Minister Gromyko is a classic example of the somber Russian. He seldom smiles, seems to have no capacity for making fun of himself or anyone else. Generally, he is as inflexible, as bullheaded, as was his famous predecessor, Molotov. But he's even more heavy-handed in his diplomatic approach. One other foreign minister came between Molotov and Gromyko. He was a former Pravda editor named Shapilov, who lasted just a little more than 8 months in the job. When Shapilov was bounced in favor of Gromyko, Premier Khrushchev said there would be no change in policy, that policy in the Soviet Union does not depend upon one man, but on the government. This has certainly been borne out. Foreign diplomats have the feeling that Gromyko has almost no freedom in policy making. Molotov, as a high-ranking old Bolshevik, did occasionally show signs of making decisions on his own, but not so with Gromyko. I've run into Gromyko several times here and in New York, and then he was a passenger on the Ile-de-France when I went to Europe in 1951. He always had with him at least two burly-looking gentlemen, presumably bodyguards. Gromyko's escorts always walked about 2 paces behind him, but I never saw Gromyko without them. They walked endlessly around the deck of the ship, but rarely talked. They did have frequent conferences in the various ship salons, but a ship's officer pointed out to me that they never seemed to sit in the same chairs twice, and they always preferred seats out in the middle of the rooms, away from walls that might have concealed microphones. All in all, they gave the impression of being somewhat surly people who had little simple fun in life and who were extraordinarily suspicious and even frightened.
The Camp David talks are being held on a very informal basis at the dinner table in the adjoining large comfortable living room with the well-upholstered chairs, perhaps at times even on the flagstone terraces outside which look out over the peaceful hills. Despite the serene setting, however, the men in Aspen Lodge have some very real troublesome issues to discuss.
This is Frank Burgholzer, NBC News State Department correspondent. The first subject on the Eisenhower-Khrushchev agenda, if logic applies tonight in Camp David, is disarmament. Both sides have talked more about this than everything else since Khrushchev arrived. The Soviet position is what Khrushchev himself outlined before the United Nations last week. His optimum plan, total disarmament, down to in effect burning the textbooks on how to fight a war. Recognizing the impracticality of this, the Russians' secondary plan, 5 points. 1, control and inspection zone in territories of corresponding countries of Western Europe, reduction of foreign troops therein. 2, a denuclearized zone in Central Europe. 3, the withdrawal of all foreign troops from Europe, the liquidation of military bases in all foreign territories. 4, a non-aggression pact between NATO and Warsaw Pact countries. 5, agreement on prevention of surprise attack. The Western position is that a distinction has to be made on the basic principle of disarmament. All the Russian proposals, says the West, are based on the assumption of disengagement, the notion that if you pull the armed forces facing each other, in Central Europe, for example, away from one another, you'll reduce tensions. In the U.S. view, this is a backward view of it. The tensions came first. With Soviet menacing of the rest of the world, the confrontation of forces resulted from these tensions rather than causing them. In this view, removing the forces rather than relieving the tensions is more likely to aggravate them by increasing dangers, thereby increasing fears, unless something happens first on political matters. And for this reason, the Western position is concentrated not on specific measures of disarmament, although Western proposals have covered lots of these, but it's concentrated rather on the control and inspection of disarmament measures. These are political steps that, in our view, would make disarmament of any dimension meaningful in reducing tensions. The Western position on cessation of nuclear testing, for example, which is one form of disarmament, calls for inspection teams inside the borders of nuclear powers, one-third Russian, one-third British, and American, and one-third neutral inspectors. The Russians until now have opposed this, called it a setup for spies. They've also insisted on veto power over all actions of any control system. These are the areas of real difference. There's been some slight indication the Russians may now give enough to permit at least a new approach to negotiations. The second major group of topics will be involved with Germany and Berlin. The Russian position is that Germany's status should be settled by a peace treaty. The facts of life indicate two separate German states, and therefore two treaties should be signed. The separate German states should settle their degree and form of reunification between themselves. In the process, the occupation status of Berlin should be ended. The sooner the better on that. The Western position is that Germany's status should indeed be settled by a peace treaty, but that this treaty can be signed only by a reunified Germany. The communist regime in East Germany is not acceptable as a spokesman for that part of Germany. There should be some system of believable representation. In the process, Berlin should again be made the capital of Germany and unoccupied, but not until all of Germany has secured self-determination. There's been some slight indication here again that Khrushchev may now be ready to make some kind of deal to take the heat off the Berlin aspect, at least, of the German problem. Bound up in both these topics, Germany and disarmament, are certain other specific differences: communist objection to the nuclear armament of the German army, German membership in NATO, and so on. These also are likely subjects of discussion, if not of compromise. Otherwise, there's the matter of trade. The Russians want certain specific anti-Soviet discriminations lifted from Soviet-American trade, and they want American credits. The American position is that the possibilities of trade are slim, even if these things are done, but some adjustments might be made if the Soviets show a willingness to honor their past debts, honor international copyright agreements, and so on. The subject of exchanges of persons, ideas, lifting travel restrictions, and so on, is being thoroughly discussed during this trip, will produce results, but probably on lower levels, may not reach the Camp David level at all. Otherwise, the one almost certain subject of discussion and agreement is the return visit to Russia by President Eisenhower, with expectations running to the 1st of November, give or take a few days either way.
The first news to come out of Aspen Lodge has just been given to reporters gathered in the newsroom in Gettysburg. For that report, we return to Martin Nagronsky in Gettysburg.
The latest announcement from the Eisenhower-Khrushchev meeting concerns the Vice President of the United States, Mr. Nixon. Mr. Hagerty, the White House Press Secretary, reports that Mr. Nixon will join the conference here at the Little Summit at Camp David tomorrow morning at 10:30, flying here by helicopter from Washington. Whatever else this Camp David meeting at the summit of the Catoctin Mountains in Maryland will produce, it will not be, so White House Press Secretary James Hagerty insists, any major agreement between the United States and Russia that might affect other nations. The very careful emphasis that both Mr. Hagerty and Assistant Secretary of State Andrew Birding chose to place on this observation about the Eisenhower-Khrushchev meeting that started here tonight demonstrates how important they regard this particular qualification. Mr. Haggerty first defined what is happening and what will happen in the secluded Aspen Lodge at Camp David like this. It would be, he said, a general discussion of the world situation rather than a discussion of any specific topic. And they would continue this discussion in this fashion. And having concluded this, he then said, I repeat, these are discussions. These are discussion meetings alone. There is to be no attempt at negotiating, particularly on topics that might concern other nations. Then along came Mr. Birding to insist about the same thing. We will discuss, there will be discussed, said Mr. Birding, only matters that are bilateral affecting the United States and Russia. And then he changed that to say that there would be no settlements made beyond those that affect only the United States and Russia. The discussion will cover the whole world, the situation. And it's understood that talks will cover the unresolved differences between the two countries over the future of Berlin and Germany, the differences over the best way for inspection of disarmament agreements, discussion of the use of force in international disputes, and the ending of nuclear weapons tests, and finally, the timing of President Eisenhower's visit to the Soviet Union. This is Martin Agronsky, NBC News, with the Eisenhower-Khrushchev party at Gettysburg.
It is likely when Nikita Khrushchev leaves Camp David Sunday, a communique will be issued telling of certain steps forward taken by the representatives of the Soviet Union and the United States. Perhaps extension of the exchange program, perhaps more exchange of scientific information, perhaps even some trade revisions. How much these steps do to truly melt the ice remains to be seen, for it is likely much work remains to be done before East and West can approach each other with something other than complete mistrust. Herb Kaplow, NBC News, Washington.
This has been Khrushchev in America, part 11 of a series of broadcasts dealing with the visit to America of Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev. Produced for NBC News by Bert Every and Russ Tornabin. Your narrator is Herb Kaplow. This is Paul Shields speaking. The 12th program in this series will be heard at the same time tomorrow over most of these same stations. This is the NBC Radio Network.